tell me how it was when you came to Rook. Though hampered by weariness, anguish, and awe, Alder had the silver tongue of his island, and what he left out for fear of going on too long or telling the Archmage what he already knew, his listener could well imagine, remembering when he himself first came to the Isle of the Wise as a boy of 15. When Alder left the ship at the docks of Thwilltown, one of the sailors had drawn the rune of the closed door on the top of the gangplank to prevent his ever coming back aboard. Alder noticed it, but he thought the sailor had good cause. He felt himself ill-omened. He felt he bore darkness in him. That made him shyer than he would have been in any case in a strange town. And Thwill was a very strange town. The streets lead you awry, Sparrowhawk said.
They do that, my lord.
I'm sorry. My tongue will obey my heart and not you. Never mind. I was used to it once. I can be Lord Goatherd again if it eases your speech. Go on. Misdirected by those he asked, or misunderstanding the directions, Alder wandered about the hilly little labyrinth of Thwilltown with the school always in sight, and never able to get to it, until having reached despair he came to a plain door in a bare wall on a dull square. After staring at it a while, he recognized the wall was the one he had been trying to get to. He knocked, and a man with a quiet face and quiet eyes opened the door. Alder was ready to say that he had been sent by the wizard Beryl of Ea with a message for the master summoner, but he didn't have a chance to speak. The doorkeeper gazed at him a moment and said mildly, "You cannot bring them into this house, friend." Alder did not ask who it was he could not bring with him. He knew. He had slept scarcely at all the past night, snatching fragments of sleep and waking in terror, dozing off in the daylight, seeing the dry grass sloping down through the sunlit deck of the ship, the wall of stones across the waves of the sea. And waking, the dream was in him, with him, around him, veiled, and he could hear, always, faintly, through all the noises of wind and sea, the voices that cried his name. He did not know if he was awake now or asleep. He was crazy with pain and fear and weariness. "Keep them out," he said, "and let me in. For pity's sake, let me in." "Wait here," the man said, as gently as before. "There's a bench," pointing. And he closed the door. Alder went and sat down on the stone bench. He remembered that, and he remembered some boys of 15 or so looking curiously at him as they went by and entered that door. But what happened for some while after, he could recall only in fragments. The doorkeeper came back with a young man with the staff and cloak of a Rook wizard. Then Alder was in a room, which he understood was in the lodging house. There the master summoner came and tried to talk with him, but Alder by then was not able to talk. Between sleep and waking, between the sunlit room and the dim gray hill, between the summoner's voice speaking to him and the voices calling him across the wall, he could not think, and he could not move in the living world. But in the dim world where the voices called, he thought it would be easy to walk on down those few steps to the wall and let the reaching hands take him and hold him. If he was one of them, they would let him be, he thought. Then, as he remembered, the sunlit room was altogether gone, and he was on the gray hill. But with him stood the summoner of Rook. A big, broad, dark-skinned man, with a great staff of yew wood that shimmered in the dim place. The voices had ceased calling. People, the crowding figures at the wall, were gone. He could hear a distant rustle and a kind of sobbing as they went down into the darkness, went away. The summoner stepped to the wall and put his hands on it. The stones had been loosened here and there. A few had fallen and lay on the dry grass. Alder felt that he should pick them up and replace them, mend the wall, but he did not. The summoner turned to him and asked, "Who brought you here?"
"My wife, Mevra."
"Summon her here." Alder stood dumb. At last he opened his mouth, but it was not his wife's true name that he spoke, but her use name, the name he had called her in life. He said it aloud, "Lily." The sound of it was not like a white flower, but like a pebble dropping on dust. No sound. Stars shone small and steady in the black sky. Alder had never looked up at the sky in this place before. He did not recognize the stars.
"Mevra," said the summoner,
and in his deep voice spoke some words in the old speech. Alder felt the breath go out of him and could barely stand, but nothing stirred on the long slope that led down to formless dark. Then there was some movement, something lighter coming up the hill, coming slowly nearer. Alder shook with fear and yearning and whispered, "Oh, my dear love." But the figure as it came closer was too small to be Lily. He saw it was a child of 12 or so, girl or boy, he could not tell. It paid no heed to him or the summoner, and never looked across the wall, but settled down just under it. When Alder came closer and looked down, he saw the child was prying and pulling at the stones, trying to loosen one, then another. The summoner was whispering in the old speech. Child glanced up once indifferently and went on tugging at the stones with its thin fingers that seemed to have no strength in them. This was so horrible to Alder that his head spun. He tried to turn away, and beyond that he could remember nothing till he woke in the sunny room, lying in bed, weak and sick and cold. People looked after him. The aloof, smiling woman who kept the lodging house, and a brown-skinned, stocky old man who came with the doorkeeper. Alder took him for a physician sorcerer. Only after he had seen him with his staff of olive wood did he understand that he was the herbal, the master of healing of the school on Roke. His presence brought solace, and he was able to give Alder sleep. He brewed up a tea and had Alder drink it, and lighted some herb that burned slowly with a smell like the dark earth under pine woods, and sitting nearby began a long, soft chant.
"But I must not sleep," Alder protested, feeling sleep coming into him like a great dark tide. The healer laid his warm hand on Alder's hand. Then peace came into Alder, and he slipped into sleep without fear.
So long as the healer's hand was on his or on his shoulder, it kept him from the dark hillside and the wall of stones. He woke to eat a little. And soon the master herbal was there again, with the tepid, insipid tea, and the earth-smelling smoke, and the dull, untuneful chant, and the touch of his hand, and Alder could have rest. The healer had all his duties at the school, so he could be there only some hours of the night. Alder got enough rest in 3 nights that he could eat and walk about the town a little in the day and think and talk coherently. On the 4th morning, the 3 masters, the herbal, the doorkeeper, and the summoner, came to his room. Alder bowed to the summoner with dread, almost distrust in his heart. The herbal was also a great mage, but his art was not altogether different from Alder's own craft, so they had a kind of understanding. And there was the great kindness of his hand. The summoner
though, dealt not with bodily things, but with the spirit, with the minds and wills of men, with ghosts, with meanings. His art was arcane, dangerous, full of risk and threat, and he had stood beside Alder there, not in the body, on the boundary, at the wall. With him, the darkness and the fear returned. None of the three mages said anything at first. If they had one thing in common, it was a great capacity for silence. So Alder spoke, trying to say what was in his heart, for nothing less would do. If I did some wrong that brought me to that place, or brought my wife to me there, or the other souls, if I can mend or undo what I did, I will. But I don't know what it is I did.
Or what you are, the summoner said. Alder was mute.
Not many of us know who or what we are, said the doorkeeper. A glimpse is all we get.
Tell us how you first went to the wall of stones, the summoner said.
Alder told them. The mages listened in silence and said nothing for a while after he was done. Then the summoner asked,
Have you thought what it means to cross that wall?
I know I could not come back.
Only mages can cross the wall living, and only at utmost need. The herbal may go with a sufferer all the way to that wall, but if the sick man crosses it, he does not follow.
The summoner was so tall and broad-bodied and dark that, looking at him, Alder thought of a bear.
My art of summoning empowers us to call the dead back across the wall for a brief time, a moment, if there is need to do so. I myself question if any need could justify so great a breach in the law and balance of the world. I have never made that spell, nor have I crossed the wall. The Archmage did, and the king with him, to heal the wound in the world the wizard called Cobb made. And when the Archmage did not return, Thorion, who was our summoner, then went down into the dry land to seek him, the herbal said. He came back, but changed.
There is no need to speak of that, the big man said. Maybe there is, said the herbal. Maybe Alder needs to know it. Thorion trusted his strength too far, I think. He stayed there too long. He thought he could summon himself back into life. But what came back was only his skill, his power, his ambition, the will to live that gives no life. Yet we trusted him because we had loved him. So he devoured us, until Irion destroyed him.
Far from Roke, on the Isle of Gaunt, Alder's listener interrupted him.
What name was that? Sparrowhawk asked. Irion, he said.
Do you know that name?
No, my lord.
Nor I.
After a pause, Sparrowhawk went on softly, as if unwillingly.
But I saw Thorion there, in the dry land where he had risked going to seek me. It grieved me to see him there. I said to him he might go back across the wall. His face went dark and grim. That was ill spoken. All is spoken ill between the living and the dead. But I had loved him too. They sat in silence. Sparrowhawk got up abruptly to stretch his arms and rub his thighs. They both moved about a bit. Alder got a drink of water from the well. Sparrowhawk fetched out a garden spade and the new handle to fit to it, and set to work smoothing the oaken shaft and tapering the end that would go in the socket. He said, Go on, Alder. And Alder went on with his story.
The two masters had been silent for a while after the herbal spoke about Thorion. Alder got up the courage to ask them about a matter that had been much on his mind. How those who died came to the wall, and how the mages came there. The summoner answered promptly, "It is a spirit journey." The old healer was more hesitant. "It's not in the body that we cross the wall, since the body of one who dies stays here. And if a mage goes there in vision, his sleeping body is still here, alive. And so, we call that voyager, we call what makes that journey from the body, the soul, the spirit. But my wife took my hand," Alder said. He could not say again to them that she had kissed his mouth. "I felt her touch."
"So it seemed to you," the summoner said.
"If they touched bodily, if a link was made," the herbal said to the summoner, "might that not be why the other dead can come to him? Call to him, even touch him?"
"That is why he must resist them," said the summoner with a glance at Alder. His eyes were small, fiery. Alder felt it as an accusation, and not a fair one. He said,
"I try to resist them, my lord. I have tried, but there are so many of them. And she's with them, and they're suffering, crying out to me."
"They cannot suffer," the summoner said. "Death ends all suffering."
"Maybe the shadow of pain is pain," said the herbal. "There are mountains in that land, and they are called pain."
The doorkeeper had scarcely spoken until now. He said in his quiet, easy voice,
"Alder is a mender, not a breaker. I don't think he can break that link."
"If he made it, he can break it," the summoner said.
"Did he make it?"
"I have no such art, my lord," Alder said, so frightened by what they were saying that he spoke angrily. "Then I must go down among them," said the summoner.
"No, my friend," said the doorkeeper, and the old herbal said, "You last of us all."
"But this is my art."
"And ours."
"Who then?"
The doorkeeper said, "It seems Alder is our guide. Having come to us for help, maybe he can help us. Let us all go with him in his vision, to the wall, though not across it."
So that night, when late and fearfully Alder let sleep overcome him and found himself on the gray hill, the others were with him. The herbal, a warm presence in the chill, the doorkeeper, elusive and silvery as starlight, and the massive summoner, the bear, a dark strength. This time they were standing not where the hill ran down into the dark, but on the near slope, looking up to the top. The wall in this place ran along the crest of the hill and was low, little more than knee height. Above it the sky, with its few small stars, was perfectly black. Nothing moved. It would be hard to walk uphill to the wall, Alder thought. Always before it had been below him. But if he could go to it, maybe Lily would be there, as she had been the first time. Maybe he could take her hand, and the mages would bring her back with him. Or he could step over the wall where it was so low and come to her. He began to walk up the hill. It was easy. It was no trouble. He was almost there.
"Ara!" The summoner's deep voice called him back like a noose around his neck, a jerked leash. He stumbled, staggered forward one step more, almost at the wall, dropped to his knees and reached out to the stones. He was crying, "Save me!" But to whom? To the mages? Or to the shadows beyond the wall? Then hands
were on his shoulders, living hands, strong and warm, and he was in his room, with the healer's hands indeed on his shoulders, and the ware-light burning white around them. And there were four men in the room with him, not three. The old herbal sat down on the bed with him and soothed him a while, for he was shaking, shuddering, sobbing. "I can't do it," he kept saying, but still he did not know if he was talking to the mages or to the dead. When the fear and pain began to lessen, he felt tired beyond bearing and looked almost without interest at the man who had come into the room. His eyes were the color of ice. His hair and skin were white. A far northerner, from Enwas or Bereswek, Alder thought him. This man said to the mages, "What are you doing, my friends?"
"Taking risks, Asbear," said the old herbal. "Trouble at the border, Patterner," said the summoner. Alder could feel the respect they had for this man, their relief that he was there, as they told him briefly what the trouble was.
"If he'll come with me, will you let him go?" the Patterner asked when they were done, and turning to Alder, "You need not fear your dreams in the imminent grove, and so we need not fear your dreams."
They all assented. The Patterner nodded and vanished.
He was not there. He had not been there. He had been ascending, a presentment.
It was the first time Alder had seen the great powers of these masters made manifest, and it would have unnerved him if he had not been past amazement and fear. He followed the doorkeeper out into the night, through the streets, past the walls of the school, across fields under a high round hill, and along a stream, singing its water music softly in the darkness of its banks. Ahead of them was a high wood, the trees crowned with gray starlight. The master patterner came along the path to meet them, looking just as he had in the room. He and the doorkeeper spoke for a minute, and then Alder followed the patterner into the grove.
"The trees are dark," Alder said to Sparrowhawk. "But it isn't dark under them. There is a light, a lightness there."
His listener nodded, smiling a little.
"As soon as I came there, I knew I could sleep.
I felt as if I'd been asleep all along in an evil dream, and now, here, I was truly awake, so I could truly sleep. There was a place he took me to, in among the roots of a huge tree, all soft with the fallen leaves of the tree, and he told me I could lie there. And I did, and I slept. I cannot tell you the sweetness of it." The midday sun had grown strong. They went indoors, and the host set out bread and cheese and a bit of dried meat. Alder looked round him as they ate. The house had only the one long room with its little western alcove, but it was large and darkly airy, strongly built, with wide boards and beams, a gleaming floor, a deep stone fireplace.
"This is a noble house," Alder said.
"An old one. They call it the old mage's house. Not for me, nor for my master Ihal, who lived here, but for his master, Heleth, who, with him, stilled the great earthquake. It's a good house." Alder slept a while again under the trees, with the sun shining on him through the moving leaves. His host rested too, but not long. When Alder woke, there was a good-sized basket of the small golden plums under the tree, and Sparrowhawk was up in the goat pasture mending a fence. Alder went to help him, but the job was done. The goats, however, were long gone. "Neither of 'em's in milk," Sparrowhawk grumbled as they returned to the house. "They've got nothing to do but find new ways through the fence. I keep them for exasperation." The first spell I ever learned was to call goats from wandering. My aunt taught me. It's no more use to me now than if I sang them a love song. I'd better go see if they've got into the widower's vegetables. You don't have the kind of sorcery to charm a goat to come, do you? The two brown nannies were indeed invading a cabbage patch on the outskirts of the village. Alder repeated the spell Sparrowhawk told him. Noth hirth malkman, hyok han merth han. The goats gazed at him with alert disdain and moved away a little. Shouting and a stick got them out of the cabbages onto the path, and there Sparrowhawk produced some plums from his pocket. Promising, offering, and cajoling, he slowly led the truants back into their pasture. "They're odd creatures," he said, latching the gate. "You never know where you are with a goat." Alder thought that he never knew where he was with his host, but did not say it. When they were sitting in the shade again, Sparrowhawk said, "The patterner isn't a northerner. He's a carg, like my wife. He was a warrior of Carrego At, the only man I know of who ever came from those lands to Roke. The Kargs have no wizards. They distrust all sorcery. But they've kept more knowledge of the old powers of the earth than we have. This man, Asver, when he was young, he heard some tale of the imminent grove, and it came to him that the center of all the earth's powers must be there. So he left his gods and his native tongue behind him and made his way to Roke. He stood on our doorstep and said, 'Teach me to live in that forest.' And we taught him, till he began to teach us. So he became our master patterner. He's not a gentleman, but he is to be trusted."
"I never could fear him," Alder said. "It was easy to be with him. He'd take me far into the wood with him."
They were both silent, both thinking of the glades and aisles of that wood, the sunlight and starlight in its leaves.
"It is the heart of the world," Alder said.
Sparrowhawk looked up eastward at the slopes of Gaunt Mountain, dark with trees. "I'll go walking there," he said, "in the forest, come autumn." After a while, he said, "Tell me what counsel the patterner had for you and why he sent you here to me."
"He said, my lord, that you knew more of the dry land than any living man, and so maybe you would understand what it means that the souls there come to me as they do, begging me for freedom."
"Did he say how he thinks it came about?"
"Yes. He said that maybe my wife and I didn't know how to be parted, only how to be joined, that it was not my doing, but was maybe ours together, because we drew each to the other like drops of quicksilver. But the master summoner didn't agree. He said that only a great power of magery could so transgress the order of the world. Because my old master Gannett also touched me across the wall, the summoner said maybe it was a mage power in him, which had been hidden or disguised in life, but now was revealed."
Sparrowhawk brooded a while. "When I lived on Roke," he said, "I might have seen it, as the summoner does. There I knew no power stronger than what we call magery. Not even the old powers of the earth, I thought. If the summoner you met is the man I think, he came as a boy to Roke. My old friend Vetch of Ifish sent him to study with us, and he never left. That's a difference between him and Asver, the patterner. Asver lived till he was grown as a warrior's son, a warrior himself, among men and women in the thick of life.
matters that the walls of the school keep out, he knows in his flesh and blood. He knows that men and women love, make love, marry. Having lived these 15 years outside the walls, I incline to think Asver might be on the better track. The bond between you and your wife is stronger than the division between life and death. Alder hesitated. I thought it might be so, but it seems shameless to think it. We loved each other more than I can say we loved each other, but was our love greater than any other before us? Was it greater than Morad's and Alfarin's? Maybe not less. How can that be? Barrowhawk looked at him as if saluting something, and answered him with a care that made Alder feel honored. Well, he said slowly, sometimes there's a passion that comes in its springtime to ill fate or death, and because it ends in its beauty, it's what the harpers sing of and the poets make stories of, the love that escapes the years. That was the love of the young king and Alfarin. That was your love, Hara. It wasn't greater than Morad's, but was his greater than yours? Alder said nothing, pondering. There's no less or greater in an absolute thing, Sparrowhawk said. All or nothing at all, the true lover says, and that's the truth of it. My love will never die, he says. He claims eternity, and rightly. How can it die when it's life itself? What do we know of eternity but the glimpse we get of it when we enter in that bond? He spoke softly but with fire and energy. Then he leaned back and after a minute said with a half smile, every oaf of a farm boy sings that. Every young girl that dreams of love knows it. But it's not a thing the masters of Roke are familiar with. The patterner, maybe, knew it early. I learned it late. Very late. Not quite too late. He looked at Alder, the fire still in his eyes, challenging. You had that, he said. I did. Alder drew a deep breath. Presently he said, maybe they're there. Together, in the dark land, Morad and Alfarin? No, Sparrowhawk said with bleak certainty. But if the bond is true, what can break it? There are no lovers there. Then what are they? What do they do there in that land? You've been there. You crossed the wall. You walked and spoke with them. Tell me! I will. But Sparrowhawk said nothing for a while. I don't like to think about it, he said. He rubbed his head and scowled. You saw. You've seen those stars. Little, mean stars that never move. No moon. No sunrise. There are roads if you go down the hill. Roads and cities. On the hill, there's grass, dead grass, but farther down there's only dust and rocks. Nothing grows. Dark cities. The multitudes of the dead stand in the streets or walk on the roads to no end. They don't speak. They don't touch. They never touch. His voice was low and dry. There, Morad would pass Alfarin and never turn his head, and she wouldn't look at him. There's no rejoining there, Hara. No bond. The mother doesn't hold her child there. But my wife came to me, Alder said. She called my name. She kissed my mouth.
Yes. And since your love wasn't greater than any other mortal love, and since you and she aren't mighty wizards whose power might change the laws of life and death, therefore, something else is in this. Something is happening, is changing. Though it happens through you and to you, you are its instrument, and not its cause. Barrowhawk stood up and strode to the beginning of the path along the cliff and back to Alder. He was charged, almost quivering with tense energy, like a hawk about to swoop down on its prey. Did your wife not say to you, when you called her by her true name, "That is not my name anymore"?
Yes, Alder whispered.
But how is that? We who have true names keep them when we die. It's our use name that is forgotten. This is a mystery to the learned, I can tell you, but as well as we understand it, a true name is a word in the true speech. That's why only one with the gift can know a child's name and give it. And the name binds the being, alive or dead. All the art of the summoner lies in that. Yet when the master summoned your wife to come by her true name, she didn't come to him. You called by her use name, Lily, and she came to you.
Did she come to you, as to the one who knew her truly?
He gazed at Alder keenly, and yet as if he saw more than the man who sat with him. After a while, he went on, "When my master Ihal died, my wife was here with him. And as he was dying, he said to her, 'It is changed. All changed.' He was looking across that wall, from which side I do not know. And since that time, indeed, there have been changes. A king on Morid's throne, and no archmage of Roke. But more than that, much more. I saw a child summon the dragon Kalesin, the eldest, and Kalesin came to her, calling her daughter, as I do.
What does that mean?
What does it mean that dragons have been seen above the islands of the West? The king sent to us, sent a ship to Gaunt Port, asking my daughter Tehanu to come and take counsel with him concerning dragons. People fear that the old covenant is broken, that the dragons will come to burn fields and cities as they did before Aerith Akbi fought with Orm Embar. And now, at the boundary of life and death, a soul refuses the bond of her name. I do not understand it. All I know is that it is changing. It is all changing." There was no fear in his voice, only fierce exultation. Alder could not share that. He had lost too much and was too worn out by his struggle against forces he could not control or comprehend. But his heart rose to that gallantry.
"May it change for the good, my lord," he said.
"Be it so," the old man said. "But change it must." As the heat went out of the day, Sparrowhawk said he had to walk to the village. He carried the basket of plums with a basket of eggs nested in it. Alder walked with him, and they talked. When Alder understood that Sparrowhawk bartered fruit and eggs and the other produce of the little farm for barley and wheat flour, that the wood he burned was gathered patiently up in the forest, that his goats not giving milk meant he must eke out last year's cheese, Alder was amazed. How could it be that the Archmage of Earthsea lived from hand to mouth? Did his own people not honor him?
When he went with him to the village, he saw women shut their doors when they saw the old man coming. The marketer who took his eggs and fruit tallied the count on his wooden tablet without a word, his face sullen and his eyes lowered. Sparrowhawk spoke to him pleasantly. "A good day to you, then, Itty," but got no answer. "My lord," Alder asked as they walked home, "do they know who you are?" "No," said the ex-archmage, with a dry, sidelong look. "And yes." "But," Alder did not know how to speak his indignation. "They know I have no power of sorcery, but there's something uncanny about me. They know I live with a foreigner, a Kargish woman. They know the girl we call our daughter is something like a witch, but worse, because her face and hand were burnt away by fire, and because she herself burnt up the Lord of Rhea Albi, or pushed him off the cliff, or killed him with the evil eye. Their stories vary. They honor the house we live in, though, because it was Ihal's and Heleth's house, and dead wizards are good wizards. You're a townsman, Alder, of an isle of Morid's kingdom. A village on Gaunt is another matter.
But why do you stay here, Lord? Surely the king would do you proper honor."
"I want no honor," the old man said, with a violence that silenced Alder entirely. They walked on. As they came to the house built at the cliff's edge, he spoke again. "This is my Aerie," he said. They had a glass of the red wine with supper and another sitting out to watch the sun set. They did not talk much. Fear of the night, of the dream, was coming into Alder. "I'm no healer," his host said, "but perhaps I can do what the Master Herbo did to let you sleep." Alder looked his question. "I've been thinking about it, and it seems to me maybe it was no spell at all that kept you away from that hillside, but just the touch of a living hand. If you like, we can try it." Alder protested, but Sparrowhawk said, "I'm awake half most nights anyway." So the guest lay that night in the low bed in the back corner of the big room, and the host sat up beside him, watching the fire and dozing.
He watched Alder, too, and saw him fall asleep at last, and not long after that saw him start and shudder in his sleep. He put out his hand and laid it on Alder's shoulder as he lay half-turned away. The sleeping man stirred a little, sighed, relaxed, and slept on. It pleased Sparrowhawk that he could do this much. As good as a wizard, he told himself with mild sarcasm. He was not sleepy. The tension was still in him. He thought about all Alder had told him and what they had talked about in the afternoon. He saw Alder stand in the path by the cabbage patch, saying the spell to call the goats, and the goats' haughty indifference to the powerless words. He remembered how he had used to speak the name of the Sparrowhawk, the Marsh Hawk, the Grey Eagle, calling them down from the sky to him in a rush of wings to grasp his arm with iron talons and glare at him, eye to wrathful golden eye. None of that anymore. He could boast, calling this house his Aerie, but he had no wings. But Tehanu did. The dragon's wings were hers to fly on. The fire had burned out. He pulled his sheepskin over him more closely, leaning his head back against the wall, still keeping his hand on Alder's inert, warm shoulder. He liked the man and was sorry for him. He must remember to ask him to mend the green pitcher tomorrow. The grass next to the wall was short, dry, dead. No wind blew to make it move or rustle. He roused up with a start, half rising from the chair, and after a moment of bewilderment put his hand back on Alder's shoulder, grasping it a little and whispered, "Hara! Come away, Anna." Alder shuddered and then relaxed. He sighed again, turned more onto his face, and lay still. Sparrowhawk sat with his hand on the sleeper's arm. How had he himself come there, to the wall of stone? He no longer had the power to go there. He had no way to find the way. As in the night before, Alder's dream or vision, Alder's voyaging soul, had drawn him with it to the edge of the dark land. He was wide awake now. He sat gazing at the grayish square of the west window full of stars. The grass under the wall, it did not grow farther down where the hill leveled out into the dim, dry land. He had said to Alder that down there was only dust, only rock. He saw that black dust, black rock. Dead stream beds where no water ever ran. No living thing. No bird. No field mouse cowering. No glitter and buzz of little insects, the creatures of the sun. Only the dead, with their empty eyes and silent faces. But did birds not die? A mouse? A gnat? A goat? A white and brown, clever-hoofed, yellow-eyed, shameless goat? Sippy, who had been Tehanu's pet and who had died last winter at a great age? Where was Sippy? Not in the dry land. The dark land. She was dead, but she was not there. She was where she belonged, in the dirt. The dirt in the light, in the wind, the leap of water from the rock, the yellow eye of the sun. Then why?